Hello, and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime and again on Fridays at 6 p.m. Real Talk is the show that I like to think of as answering questions large and small. And today we've got some really interesting, fun questions. We are all going to be feasting this week, and it's time to talk about food and why the heck we feast on the things that we actually do. I have a quote here from M.F.K. Fisher in a book called How to Cook a Wolf. I believe that one of the most dignified ways we are capable of to assert the and reassert our dignity in the face of poverty and wars, fears and pains, is to nourish ourselves with all possible skill, delicacy, and ever-increasing enjoyment. And with our gastronomical growth will come, inevitably, knowledge and perception of 100 other things, but mainly of ourselves. Then fate, even tangled as it is with cold wars as well as hot, cannot harm us. That kind of bespeaks Thanksgiving, perhaps, this year. And I have with me the person who brought me that quote and who is an aficionado of food and culture. She's Linda Nygaard. Welcome, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So you've got all kinds of stories for us about how it is we got to eating the things that we eat and what are they? So I've always wondered where soup came from.
Well, I was reading an article just the other day, as a matter of fact, and soup, archaeologists have recently discovered that soup was invented by the Chinese 20,000 years ago.
Wow.
And they found an excavation site where there's evidence of the Chinese having dug a big hole in the ground, lined it with animal skins, and then in that hole, they put vegetables or bones or whatever it was they put in their soup and a lot of water, and they took hot rocks from a nearby fire, put that in the soup, in the pit, and covered it up and let it steep. That back then, 20,000 years ago, there were no vessels to boil things in, so it steeped in the ground. And that is thought to be the very first pot of soup.
It sounds almost like vegetable tea.
Kind of. It doesn't sound very appetizing.
But the animal skins and so forth.
Yeah.
But not something that we would go for.
Probably not now. Probably not in this day and age. But it's interesting. And I'd like to learn more about what did they find in those pits of soup? Because there are things that there's remnants of certain kinds of vegetation and certain animal bones and that kind of thing. So,
And I'm wondering, too, I've always thought of soup as the economical way to use old vegetables or bones to make sure that the carcass or the meat that you use, every bit of it is functional, if you will. And I'm wondering what they were thinking. I always wonder, what were people thinking when they decided this particular whatever was good?
That's the whole thing behind food history, is who thought of eating this cactus?
Yeah.
Or who thought of eating that hard bean? I mean, who thought of that? So I've just had a wandering mind that likes to look at history and food and culture.
Mm-hmm. So that's the history of soup. It came
kind
from
of. I mean,
China.
It's much bigger than that, and I don't know all the details about it. But it moved from China, as a lot of things did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then now we have our pot of turkey soup next week.
That's right. Using up the turkey.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because that's
not at my house. I won't have it at my house, but
you won't have soup. I won't have turkey soup at your house. You don't do that.
I don't do turkey. Sorry.
Oh. Well, that's an interesting observation in and of itself. How strange.
Well,
and of course the whole question of why we eat turkey on Thanksgiving is another one, but we're not gonna go there
right now. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm really curious. You told me you have a story about the origin of salt.
Oh, well, salt is a very interesting thing. You know, we take it for granted. You reach for the salt, you have it. If you don't have it, you miss it. You want to have it. So salt is thought to have first made it seen in Roman days when it was used as salary for the Roman soldiers.
Oh, salary as in
they got paid.
Medium of exchange.
They got paid. Okay. It was a medium of exchange, yes. And from the word salary comes the word salt. Also, there's a really interesting story about the medieval kings who had in their great banquet halls filled with all their treasures and all their people, they would have the banquets and the dinners, and the king and queen and his immediate family would be seated at the top on a stage, kind of, and they would look down on all the commoners that were invited. And of course, there were some people who weren't commoners, but they were regal, and they got to sit up front.
Royalty.
Royalty family, and, you know, the people with the right money.
Yeah.
And so then the salt was in a big bowl at the king's table, and the king's table was the only table that had the salt, because he was the only one worthy of that expensive salt. But he would salt his food, his table would salt their food, and then they'd pass it to the first table on the floor. And they'd salt their food, and they'd pass it all the way back. And by the time it got to the back of the house, there was no salt left in the bowl. And those people didn't get any because they weren't worth their salt.
So, hence the saying, one is worth their salt. So it's obviously, it wasn't easy to get. It was a medium of exchange.
It was a medium of exchange, and it was highly trafficked back then. The other thing about it is it was used as salary, but it was also used as a measure of respect. The saying, if you are worth your salt, then I respect you.
Oh, but because that's based on an economic value.
It is all based on an economic value. And today we don't even think of salt as economic, really. We just
we
want
still
it.
Use that. Yeah, we still use that phrase. And it's interesting to me that it went from Roman times as a medium of exchange, mm-hmm. And really kind of elevated to a signature or a sign of one's value, one's standing.
Worth.
Yeah.
One's worth. Worth your salt.
Which is measured on heredity, property, your standing in
society. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Very interesting. And I'm figuring it must have been, we must have found easier ways to obtain salt since the medieval times, because it's
well, I think so. And you know, now you look at all the different salts that are available in the world, the Himalayan salts,
yeah.
and the Irish sea salts and the French salts, and they're all different and they're all harvested differently. And there's a book by Mark Kurlansky. It's Kurlansky, and it's called Salt. And it gives really kind of the history of the world according to salt. And all that information is in there. And of course, not much of it's in my mind anymore.
You know, there's a time in life when we have to sort of offload all the information that's
right.
in our minds and focus on that which is really important.
Right.
Okay. So I'm really interested in this one. This is the story of chocolate.
Mm.
And we'll be eating a lot of chocolate this week, folks.
We hope so. I'll be eating yes. chocolate, that's mm-hmm. for sure. Well, what I know about chocolate is that in common history, it's thought to have originated with the Aztecs. And you can find Aztec ruins with cocoa beans and ground up cocoa powder. But about a year ago, some archaeologists discovered in Ecuador some vessels containing cocoa beans. And they did research on the vessels and on the cocoa beans, and they found that actually it originated in the Amazon, in that whole area down there. And some 1,400 years before it was found in Mexico. So the Amazonians tend to think of the Mexicans as having exploited their chocolate. And so now the whole tide is turning about who had it first. And it's a big debate.
I wonder what would come of that.
I don't know. I'm going to follow it. I'll let you know.
There are many, many Mexican recipes
mm-hmm.
that include chocolate, including
mole.
Mole, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorites.
It is.
And each mole sauce, I think, is different.
They're all different, yeah.
But they do all include chocolate.
I don't know that all of them do, because sometimes there's a green mole, and I don't think it has chocolate in it.
That may not have chocolate in it.
But most of them do, and that's mostly what we think about when we think about mole, is chocolate. Also, you might be interested to know that chocolate goes in some people's coq au vin.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
in France?
It's not a, you know, often thought of addition, but it does deepen the flavors. And
so chocolate, when it's not sweetened, is a whole different
animal.
Yeah.
It's a powder and it's pretty bitter. It doesn't taste really good.
Mm-hmm.
But fine ground chocolate is a gift from the gods.
And that's why
literally
the Ecuadorians and the Aztecians are fighting, or the Mexicans are fighting over it. Do you know whether chocolate is as ubiquitous in Ecuadorian or South American recipes as it is in Mexican recipes?
I haven't done that research yet, and I'm eager to do it because I don't know a lot about South American cooking, and that's kind of my next venture, is to look at that.
Interesting. We're talking with Linda Nygaard, who is an aficionado of food and culture, and you're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. We can do this thanks to support from Windermere Real Estate. They make our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Linda, what brought you to this whole notion of food and culture?
Some really smart people I know that piqued my curiosity. And there is a whole, you know, states have food historians. They employ food historians. Countries have food historians. College professors are food historians. And I grew up in a food family on a ranch in Montana. And I often wondered why my mother was still baking the things that her great-grandmother did. And where did that come from? And how did they do that? And so I've just kind of always been interested in it.
I'm looking here and it says the cuisine of the United States reflects its history. The European colonization of the Americas yielded the introduction of European ingredients and cooking styles to the U.S. Later in the 20th century, the influx of immigrants from many foreign nations developed a rich diversity in food preparation throughout the country. What that says to me is that food that came from other cultures to the United States kind of got, if you will, amended.
Like, by American cooks?
By American cooks, mm-hmm. or by maybe what was by available
mm-hmm.
in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've changed everything. You know, we change everything. And when you go back in history to handwritten recipes,
mm-hmm.
you see that there might be the same ingredients, but it's different kinds of flavors. There was a period in time when sour was sought after as opposed to sweet. There was a
here
period
in the U.S.?
That was Europe.
Oh, that was Europe.
Yeah, it may have been here, but I'm mm-hmm. thinking specifically of Europe. So all the different ingredients can make different dishes depending on how much you use of one thing and depending on what taste profile you're looking for.
And that makes me think of Mexican food, which, to my mind, usually has the same ingredients, but somehow they manage to make each dish just a little different.
Just a little bit differently.
But it's always tomatoes and jalapenos and...
Well, you know, if we go to Mexico, the food's so different from how it is here. It's so fresh and so beautiful. And, you know, they use all their produce. They even use their ugly produce. And they don't... It's a different situation down there, and I love to eat in Mexico.
And that's an example of how we in the U.S. have altered or amended Mexican mm-hmm. food. We've mm-hmm. done it with Chinese food as
We've
well.
We've done it with Chinese as well.
So what about pie? Pie. Where did it come from?
Well.
Is that European?
Yeah, Roman. It's thought to have been invented, or the first pie is thought to have been in Rome. And it wasn't very good. It was most pies were meat back in those days. They were meat pies. And they had a crust that was, you know, so thick you couldn't cut it, really.
Was there some functional reason for putting it in a crust?
Well, one book I read said that sometimes they were baked in cylinders. The crust was formed in a cylinder, and it was a very thick cylinder. So it was mostly flour and water, because they didn't use much fat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would put all the meat and vegetables or whatever in it and put a lid on it and then bake it. And then sometimes they'd take the insides out and use that tube of that container again for a different pie. So it wasn't really, pie crust back then wasn't really what we think of as pie crust now, tender and flaky. And, you know, it was a vessel at that time. And
sort of like clay.
It's kind of like, you'd have to get a, you know, hammer and, what do you call those things?
Chisel.
Hammer and chisel. And then in England, the first pie is thought to have been there around the 12th century. And those were pretty ugly pies too. You know, mostly pigeons and squirrels and things like that. And then the sweet pies came much later, they had, as influenced by the French.
But let me back up to the pigeon pies. This sounds to me again like a food that was originated in poverty.
It was. They had to use what they had, period. And if it was a pigeon, it was a pigeon. You know, along with no sugar. Salt was hard to find. So we can think about those flavors as not being what we would like today. But in that day, it was a wonderful feasty food.
So when did they start introducing fat and where did it come from?
Well, fat, when they started introducing it, was that I don't know. But it was always lard. They used lard. Nowadays, we like to use leaf lard, which is a kidney lard. On the pig, it's a special place. And then
leaf lard is not from vegetables, it's from kid.
No,
from
it's not pigs? A vegetable.
Ooh. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, I'm so sorry to break the news to you like that. So lard is a different thing.
So lard does come from animals.
It's
and
animal
presumably
fat.
They started, somebody discovered that that fat was usable with flour.
With flour, and it would make a different product. It made something else besides paste. So that's what they started. And then by, you know, later in the later years, there's one little tidbit I want to share with you, excuse me for stumbling, is funeral pie.
Oh, yes. And that, funeral pie.
Yeah, that was in medieval England. And they had a funeral pie that was really bare bones meat. And it had a huge set of instructions about how you prepare this particular pie for a funeral. And the person who wrote the recipe had it all written out, very explicit instructions. And it's called funeral cold pie.
Funeral?
No, it's not cold, sorry. It's called funeral pie. And at the very end of the recipe, he said, "And you can serve this cold at your mother's wedding."
Ooh, that says a lot about the culture.
Say a lot. Well,
at the time.
So see, there's some cultural things there too.
So, what are we to take from that? That this person obviously didn't like his stepfather.
He didn't want a stepmother, I would think, or had a bad experience with his stepmother. But if you do a lot of research and look in old recipes, there's often a lot of humor in them, and there's always a family story. Somehow, it started at somebody's table. At somebody's kitchen somewhere, whether that kitchen was outside in the desert, like the Bedouins with their preserved lemons. They discovered lemons and oh my gosh, they had to have lemons, but they couldn't keep them in the desert. So they figured out a way to preserve them with salt.
Salt. Again.
Again. Yeah. So someone thought of that. Someone thought, how can I do this? And so our progression of food through the centuries has shown us that we continue to invent and reinvent and invent and reinvent. And still, it's the same thing. It's around the table.
Around the table where we share one another.
Really,
share,
we do. And we strengthen ourselves and learn something. You know, you think about your table and the things that are on it, the things that have been on it, elbows, pies, babies, beers, and the talk of history at the table, those family histories and community histories. I grew up in a Montana farming family in a Mennonite community in Montana. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't of that community, but I learned a lot from them because of their German history and the German food that they have. And everyone starts talking about it when you bring it up. Oh, my grandmother this, or my great-grandmother, or my grandmother who made biscuits on a wagon, in the wagon trail.
How did that work?
Well, she was 16, really? You want to know this story?
Yeah.
She was 16 and she got married in Texas. And the day they got married, she and her husband left Texas on their way to Canada in a covered wagon. And she had a barrel of flour there. And my aunts and great aunts still tell stories about how great grandma, her name was Mai, could make a well in that barrel of flour and add all of her ingredients and then whip it up and make the tenderest biscuits without leaving a crumb in that barrel to ferment or otherwise spoil the rest of the flour. And nobody in the family thinks they can make the biscuits as well as she did. So there's a whole story there about survival and how they did that. They ended up staying in Wyoming for a year, and then they went to British Columbia and started their lives.
That sounds like magic.
Magic and hard work.
I mean, making biscuits out of a barrel without leaving, leaving a crumb in the flour.
Nothing in the flour.
That's pretty.
That's an art, and that's something that people strive toward. I can't make a biscuit to save my life. I can't. I make hockey pucks. So, you know, if anybody knows how to make biscuits, I'm up for a lesson.
We're talking with food and culture aficionado Linda Nygaard here on Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon. And, of course, this is the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, and we will be feasting with family. In a time when I think some people are actually afraid of the conversations they're going to have because of the current state of politics. So maybe we keep those conversations to our food traditions.
And maybe we all eat some humble pie.
What's the origin of humble pie? Do you have any idea about
that? I don't know.
I
shouldn't have said that before I knew where it came from. I don't know.
I'm guessing it has to do with poverty again.
Again, probably.
With
a very
people,
humble person with his humble pie.
Yeah, right.
Probably so. Everything's related to money, I think.
Yeah.
It just goes there.
It's all about economics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And economic status.
Mm-hmm. And food disparity throughout the culture. You know, that's a whole other issue that we could talk about another time, is how people deal with the economics of our times right now, because there are, you know, the food bank is feeding more and more people all the time. So there's even a history story about the food bank that we can talk about another time.
Well, and let's talk about when you're going to talk about this, because I'd like to be the one to expose the fact that you are going to start a show here on the Voice of Vashon.
Yeah, that's what they tell me.
The first of the year, actually January 2nd will be your first show. Yeah. And what's the name of it?
Stirring the Pot.
So what are you going to talk about there?
Well, you know, I have lots of little stories, and I have some that I would like to share and some people that I know who have good stories too. And we're going to talk about food on Vashon. Who's cooking what in whose kitchen, and where did that recipe come from, and why is it good, and why do you love it? And I already know so many wonderful cooks on Vashon. Also, you know, yogurt makers and goat cheese people and vintners and the people that raise lambs and then slaughter them and the vegans. And there's just so much food culture on Vashon. And most of it has a long history. So we're going to be talking with local people about what they do and why they do it. And we're always going to have a recipe of some kind. Sometimes it will be I know a couple comedians that will have a lot of fun talking about food. I know a couple of actors, and it's not going to always be chefs or cooks. It's going to be people interested in food, its history, and how it binds us as community.
Sounds wonderful. So folks, watch for that at the start of the year here on the Voice of Vashon at KVSH 101.9 FM on Vashon Island and at voiceofvashon.org. You've been listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and always happy to be here and seek answers to questions, large and small. So if you've got a question, send it to me at realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. Thanks to all of you for listening, and thanks to the composer of our theme music. He is Luke McQuillan. Have a great holiday, folks. Welcome to Real Talk Special, Lyons on Lit with Mary Fran Lyons. She brings us book reviews. She's our version of Nancy Pearl. This week, Mary Fran is going to tell us about Midnight in Broad Daylight by Pamela Rottner Yakimoto?
Sakamoto.
Sakamoto. I can't read my handwriting. Welcome, Mary Fran.
Thank you for having me. So this book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, is one that if I had to pick a book in the last 5 years that I've told more people to read than any other book, it would be this book.
Really?
And here is why. This book is about, the subtitle is A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds, but it also has some local color. So this is a Japanese-American family that really straddled Japan and the U.S. They lived for a time in Seattle, so you know, they spent some time, I want to say, in the Aurora neighborhood or Auburn or somewhere. I don't know all the neighborhoods here. But they, you know, they spent time in their formative years here. But then, as World War II started, two of the brothers were caught in Japan, and then a brother and a sister were caught here. And what's so amazing about this book is that they almost were everywhere that they, you know, that they could have been to be important in that war. So, for example, the sister went to an internment camp. The brother here was in the U.S. military. His two brothers there were in the Japanese military, to the point where he wondered if he would actually encounter them. And as it turned out, he did bump into somebody at one point in the war that he remembered fighting with years earlier. He ran into this man who was a prisoner of war and remembered him. So it's a very intense book in that respect. When I read it, I was totally riveted. And I would say the thing that for me is most profound about this book is that the, I don't quite know how to say this without almost sounding racist, but I don't mean this in a racist way. I, as a Westerner, have always found it a little difficult to tell what people that are Asian of any stripe are thinking or feeling, because we are so much more emotive than they are. And so, you know, the thing that you grew up with, you know, the Japanese and the Germans and don't buy Japanese cars and, you know, those kinds of prejudices, this book takes you behind that mask or that inability to interpret better than any book that I have ever seen or read. And it's just, it's very telling because they become very real people to the point where you have much more empathy for even the Japanese people who, I might add, attacked us, but it was their leaders that attacked us.
Of course.
It wasn't and they were all misled by their leaders as to what was going on in the war. So I found my empathy for the Japanese going up considerably as a result of reading this, but it was just such an amazing look behind the scenes that I found just terrifically informative. And I've read a lot about war, so that's saying a lot.
Yeah, and it sounds like this whole family would have been representatives of the entire Japanese experience during World War II. Almost iconic.
Absolutely, and to the point where they family members were there when the atomic bombs went off. They had
In Nagasaki and Hiroshima?
In Hiroshima. And one of the aunts had a store that, you know, went in and out of business because of what was happening in the war. So, you know, many, many very relevant things. It's almost like wherever there was something important happening in the war, somebody in this family was there. And I really commend this woman that wrote it. She is apparently a professor teaching in Hawaii. And lived in Japan for some years and was interested in this sort of thing, and I think was doing some writing. And someone introduced her to one of these family members, Harry, and she started on this huge research project as a result of that. And that's what led to this book. But it's just a tremendous, tremendous narrative with amazing research and just wonderful detail that just brings it. It makes it personal in a way that nothing else I've ever read could.
And that's always the best way to understand an historic story.
Correct. It's just so illuminating. And I'm saying I probably have told a dozen people to make sure they read this book. I don't know how many have, but I certainly, and I've even sent it to a couple people. So.
And it looks like you can get it at the library because it looks like a library book to me.
I borrowed it so that I could bring it and I could be looking at it.
Uh-huh. So that is Midnight in Broad Daylight by Pamela Rottner Sakamoto. And our book reviewer is Mary Fran Lyons.
I gave away my copy.
Thanks, Mary Fran.
Thanks for having me.